Warning, this show is about true crime, and its contents may not be appropriate for children.
This is the Crimecasters Network with Alicia Sophias and Ronnie Dahl, two rogue reporters breaking newsroom rules to take you behind the crime scene tape.
Cheers, Crimecasters. This is one of the most chilling, brazen murders you can imagine, because a mom walking with her little girl into the zoo is gunned down in broad daylight. But that was only the first horrible death that day. And Alicia, this is really the reason you and I started this podcast.
It's true, Ronnie, because every reporter has a case she just can't stop thinking about that haunts her. And this one is mine, because for the past 20 years, like her family and friends, I want to know why Bernita White doesn't have justice, especially since police think they know exactly who killed her. And that man is one of their own. He says they've got it all wrong, and he's gone to great lengths to prove it. You've heard the phrase sex, lies, and videotape. This case has those elements and so much more. But it all comes down to a mother of two beautiful little girls who never got a chance to raise them. Let's begin in 2001 in the capital of Michigan, which, no, is not Detroit, but Lansing. From the outside looking in, Bernita White has a perfect life. She's 41, smart and beautiful, great job, married to handsome state trooper, artist, has two adorable daughters, Alana and Michaela. But it's far from a fairy tale inside her home, and her best friends know it. That Easter, one of them has her annual Easter egg hunt, and Bernita and the girls never miss it. This time, though, Bernita is acting uneasy. They say almost a little paranoid.
We've had girlfriends that have been going through tough times. So did they ask her what was going on?
Yeah, absolutely. But it was hard to get her to talk too much, because this time Bernita thinks Artis is planting bugs to spy on her. So she was actually kind of afraid to say much. We'll get more into that later. See, the couple has not been the beacon of wedded bliss for a while. According to her friends, Artis is cheating on her, and it's not the first time. And he thinks she's cheating on him, too. There very well may have been infidelity on both sides, but Bernita's a very private person, so she's not out there spilling all the tea to anyone who will listen. She's just not like that.
She knows this marriage of nearly 12 years is beyond repair, so on May 24th, Bernita files for divorce, and she wants the kids. She files for sole custody. Here's the unusual thing. Neither of them move out of the family home. They both stay under the same roof because they don't want to disrupt the girls' lives. They are their number one priority here. But Alicia, this living situation cannot be easy.
No, it's not, especially with what Bernita knows about her husband. Like I said, Bernita keeps a lot close to the vest, but she has shared enough with her two closest friends and her mother, Barbara, to throw up some huge red flags. Bottom line, Bernita is worried what Artis may do. And it's sticky because, remember, he's a Michigan State trooper. 3 weeks later, there's another family court meeting, and something happens after, something that scares Bernita even more. The next day, June 14th, she writes a letter about the incident and sends it off to the court.
I'm holding a copy of that letter, and I know you FOIA'd the Michigan State Police to get this, but unfortunately, I can't really tell you what it says. It's a huge mystery because it's practically no more than a big old black box. It's nearly entirely redacted. How did you even know that this letter existed for you to put in the FOIA request?
Well, because a source very close to the family told me about it, and this person does not want to come forward right now, but they say Bernita was afraid for her life. And if that's what's behind this black box, she was 100% right. The next day, June 15th, a circuit court judge rules Bernita and Artis White will have temporary joint custody of the girls. About a week later, the pair are back in court, and Bernita calls her best friend from the bathroom. One of those hysterical, like where you have to tell your friend, please calm down so I can understand you type calls. Her friend tells me Bernita was like, Artis is blackmailing me to get permanent joint custody, but I need full custody. And her friend is like, why is this so important? Joint custody is pretty standard. And Bernita keeps telling her hysterically, no, you don't understand. You don't understand. That was the last time her best friend would ever speak to her.
On June 22nd, Bernita's attorney files court papers alleging a private investigator is following Bernita around, a PI that Artis hired. The attorney says Artis is also threatening her, saying he will reveal personal things about her unless she agrees to joint custody. While things get nasty in court, things are almost leave it to Beaver at home in front of the kids. Mom and dad are still going through the motions of a normal life to shield them, especially the next day, Saturday, June 23rd. Both girls have birthday parties to go to, and it's a family affair. It's also a beautiful, sunny, warm day, perfect for the parties because they're both outside. Mom, dad, Alana, and Michaela load up in the family van for a day of fun. First stop, Delta Mills Park, to drop off 7-year-old Alana at her party. The other three mingle a bit and then drive 10 miles away to Potter Park Zoo, where 5-year-old Michaela's friend is having another party.
Yeah, and this one is in two parts. First, at the zoo's pavilion for a picnic, then inside the zoo to check out the animals. The family only plans on going to part one, but Michaela really wants to see those animals, and can you blame a 5-year-old? So Artis is like, I'll tell you what, Bernita, you take Michaela into the zoo, I'll go get Alana, and we'll pick you two up later. Deal? Okay. He takes off in the van. Bernita gathers her things, grabs Michaela's hand, and the two walk toward the zoo entrance. And that's when the unthinkable happens. A loud bang echoes in the park. It's a single high-powered rifle bullet that soars through the air, enters Bernita's left arm, pierces her heart, and exits the right side of her body. She drops to the cement in front of her little girl, and all hell breaks loose because there is a sniper at the zoo. It came screeching over the police scanner in the Fox 47 newsroom where I was alone at the time. I almost trip running in my pink slippers to reach it. I'll never forget it. I squelched the volume up just in time to hear it again. Active shooter at the zoo, in a panicked voice, at least one down. I grab the clunky landline receiver, now this is 2001, before we use cell phones for everything, and hit speed dial to reporter Damon Fernandez, now at WFAA in Dallas. He rushes to the zoo and sets up a camera to get a shot of the entrance, hits record, and just lets everything play out. Through the lens, he watches the following. A man walks up to the officers in charge of the barricade, talks to them for a minute, then laughs.
The hard part about this is who it was.
Exactly. That man is Artis White. Artis does have an explanation. Let's read his exact recollection. He says he approached a Lansing officer that he knew. You play the cop, I'll be Artis. Artis asks, what's going on, big brother?
Just had a shooting.
Really? That's why I can't get in the front. What happened?
Some middle-aged woman took one through the chest.
Artis says, with my gallows humor, he replied, well, I hope it's not my wife. Things are rough, but it's not that bad. End quote.
Let's back up just a little bit. The timeline goes like this. The shooting happened at about 3:30, right after Potter Park Security Patrol locks up the gates before anyone can leave.
Yeah, and to give everyone an idea, there are like 300 people inside, so it's pretty chaotic.
Here's the thing. The ongoing theory is that there is a barricaded sniper inside. So when Lansing police show up, they open the gates to get everyone out to safety. The problem later is that they missed the opportunity to interview potential witnesses, right? At 4:15, police rope the zoo and the pavilion off with crime scene tape and begin a more thorough investigation. At 4:30, which is shortly after Artis and Alana showed up, the uncomfortable conversation happens. Shortly after, they inform him that indeed his wife is the one who died. Then they take him to Sparrow Hospital for the official identification process. back at the zoo, about 20 officers, six detectives, and every available dog tracking team combed the park, the zoo, and the surrounding neighborhoods, while a state police helicopter does an aerial search. This will go on all night, but they never find the shooter.
Meanwhile, Bernita's friends and family are about to get the news, and it's going to take another deadly turn. Officers knock on Bernita's parents' house to tell them in person. When Barbara hears this, she, of course, is hysterical, so inconsolable that once police leave, other relatives go get her daughter, Bridget, who lives a couple doors down. Here is what Bridget tells me happened on that horrible day. Bridget rushes to the house and asks, "Mom, what's going on?" Now, Barbara is on the floor, basically kicking and screaming and hitting the floor with her fists. And she tells her, "Bernita is dead. Bernita is dead." But what she says next sends even more chills up her spine, because she says, "He did it. He killed her." Bridget says, "What? Who?" Artis killed her. Bridget wants to know what the heck she's talking about. And Barbara starts telling her that Bernita had been confiding in her about her marriage and about being afraid of him. She's spewing out their conversation so quickly that Bridget tells her, "Listen, Mom, you need to write all of this down. We've got to get this to police." So Barbara stands up to walk to her desk to get her favorite notebook. And when she does, she collapses at Bridget's feet and has a heart attack. At the hospital, she dies. Bernita and now Barbara on the same night. Can you even imagine? Barbara's husband, Benny, says she truly died of a broken heart.
It's really so sad. And, you know, while this is happening, Artis is being questioned by Lansing police. The interrogation lasts 6 hours, during which he tells them he has no idea who killed his wife, and it definitely was not him. He says he was on a cell phone the entire drive from Potter Park to Delta Mills Park, and there's no way he could have done it. The following day, June 24th, Artis lawyers up. He refuses to take a polygraph and stops doing interviews. Michigan State Police put him on paid leave and discover he had been using LEAN, which is the Law Enforcement Information Network, to spy on Bernita and track her whereabouts. Alicia, I know officers who have been busted for this. I'm surprised Artis wasn't fired at this point.
Well, yeah, and back then, guess what? It was not a crime like it is now. So that's why he was just put on leave. But now we know Bernita was right about those instincts she was having. On June 25th, police determined Bernita was shot by a high-powered rifle coming from the northern border of the zoo from a wooded area, and say based on that trajectory, it could not have been an accident or a random shooting. It is, for sure, a targeted killing. One of the many problems, though, no bullet. Investigators need to find that bullet. They search everywhere, including the nearby river. They even cut down and x-ray a tree that may have a bullet hole. It turns out to be nothing. Police execute a search warrant on the family's home and confiscate computers, Artis's camcorder, and videotapes. And on back-to-back days, family members, including Artis, go to Bernita's funeral, then Barbara's funeral. The emotions are at an all-time high. Sadness, shock, tension, the works.
Although investigators don't come out and say it publicly right away, Artis is their number one suspect from day one. They say he had motive, opportunity, and of course, knew his way around a rifle. That being said, it is all a circumstantial case at this point. No bullet, no murder weapon, no video of the shooting. Still, Lansing police took their case against him to the Ingham County prosecutor at least twice over the years, but the prosecutor didn't think there was enough evidence to move forward.
Yeah, that prosecutor later went to jail for his own crimes, but that's a story for another day. Next, Michigan State Police took the case to the Attorney General's office. Now, twice. We'll talk more about that later. Back to 2001, MSP reinstates Artis in October, and he remained in the department for another decade or so before he retired. He was never arrested, never charged, never tried for Bernita's death. In 2003, though, he did publish a book. The title is Who Killed My Wife?
Okay, I'm maybe dating myself a little bit here, but that reminds me of the name of OJ's book.
I did it. Okay, so yeah, you're not the first to draw comparisons to that. In the book, artist says, quote, "It is very difficult because there is only one victim, one real victim, who paid the ultimate sacrifice, the sacrifice of her life. It is laborious for me because I feel like the victim," end quote. He also taunts investigators, writing, "It is quite apparent that LPD, which is Lansing Police, has no evidence whatsoever. If they had any evidence against me, I would have been arrested a long time ago." Bernita's sister, Belinda, takes out a section in the Lansing State Journal every year on Bernita's birthday and on the anniversary of her death, just to remind everyone in the community that her sister's murder is still unsolved. Police say it is not unsolved, just uncharged. My revealing, unfiltered interview with the first lead detective on this case next. You want to hear this.
You're listening to Crimecasters Network.
So we sit here 20 years later with no arrest in Bernita's case. Police have always shied away from coming out and calling Artist White a suspect, but what do we say on this show?
We love retired detectives.
Yes, that's true, because they can be a lot more, shall we say, candid now. Here is retired Lansing Police Sergeant Darren Larner, who was in charge of the detectives that led to the investigation back in 2001.
You can see footage. We actually got some videotapes of the area while it was happening. Somebody had a video camera, and you can see people hiding behind trees. They didn't even know where the shots were coming from, but they only heard one, so.
And at that time, you don't know if there's more than one victim. You don't know if there's a person, a sniper out there still, an armed gunman running around Lansing. What do you guys do? What's protocol now?
That was a tough scene. That's one of the toughest scenes that I've ever seen. They thought they had an active shooter, so they wanted to get everybody out of the park as quick as they can. But as we're shooing people out of that park, every one of them is a prospective witness. So as the investigation went back on, we had to go through and try to find out exactly who was in the park. There was over 300 people, I think, in the park that day, so.
And that was 20 years ago. That's before social media. That's before it's easy to get the word out. So you guys kind of used us in the media a little bit.
Yes.
I remember you even asked if any of the people who had visited may have a bullet hole in their car, right?
Yes, we did.
So you needed some help from the community.
Big time. We reached out to the community big time. Because we kept running into cement walls when we'd follow up on leads, and we searched really hard for the bullet, because the shot actually went through Bernita, exited her, but we never were able to recover that. But we reached out, we used so many different avenues of people and citizens and experts and stuff to try to figure this case out. It's mind blowing.
Chaotic scene.
Chaotic.
Fast forward, you end up at the hospital. And are we at Sparrow Hospital?
We're at Sparrow Hospital in the emergency section, yes.
They had just said Bernita White they had declared her dead.
Yes.
At Sparrow Hospital.
Yes.
And you're there.
Yes.
What happens?
Well, we went in to observe the body, obviously, as detectives. Pretty chaotic scene, because it's a trooper's wife, you know what I mean? We don't know any of the background or anything, so it's just a really chaotic, if you've ever been in an emergency, you know what I'm talking about. It can get very chaotic. They've got people coming and going and running. And then the next thing I know, one of the sergeants from LPD came up to me and said, "Well, I just want you to know that the husband had left just before she was shot." He said that to me like three times, and because there was so much going on, it didn't sink in, and then all of a sudden I'm like, oh. So then, a couple of minutes later, somebody brought Artist White in the room to view his wife. And I'll never forget, as long as I live, and everybody in the room said the same thing. The look on his face was just like, he did it. I can't even explain it. You would have had to see the look on his face. It was almost like he walked in there just to make sure that the job was done. That's the sense that I got.
Scary.
Yeah. almost like, and I understand that he does have some acting, he has taken some acting classes and things like that, and it just, I don't know, it's hard to explain. I wish I could almost videotaped it. He just kind of looked at her, glanced at her, looked away, and not really any kind of remorse or anything like that. And if there was anything, if you were there, you just felt, wow, that was fake.
You guys are trained to look for things like that. In fact, you're collecting clues everywhere.
Right.
The second you hear about this. Yeah. That was something that you filed right away.
It did, yeah. That stuck with me. There's a few things that have stuck with me in this case, but that's one of them. And then, you know, after you're a cop for a long time, man, you got to start trusting your gut. And, you know, that's just how I felt that day. But I knew we had to do the investigation, obviously.
Yeah. You jumped right into it. In fact, a couple days later, you're leading this thing. What was that like?
As a sergeant in charge of the detective bureau, I'm kind of like the general manager of the detective. So I'm the guy that needs to have all the information brought to me. I need to know what's going on, but I've got all these detectives that are working their tail off. And I mean working their tail off. I don't even remember going home for like the first 3 days. It was just information and MSP. And I read in Artis's book that he said there was some sort of a power struggle between MSP and Lansing police. That is 100% false. I was in Tri-County Metro Narcotics, and I worked with the state police. I had several friends in the state police, and actually some of those were in charge at the time. I got with them, we formed a task force, and we started in the center of the investigation, which is what you always have to do. Who would have wanted Bernita White to be dead? And through this investigation that it is ongoing today, 20 years later, they are still at the center of that. So
you could never get out of that circle.
No, and I'll tell you, we tried. We tried really hard. And, you know, I get chills talking about this because I just remember seeing how hard all those people worked in that task force. And some of them are still great friends to this day. And we all, whenever we see each other, we're just like, you know, someday. I don't know. There's so many parts about this that it still bothers me to this day that she was shot in front of her daughter. You know, it's just, I don't know, it's a sad case, but it took on a life of its own once we got going. I mean, and there was so much information pouring in, and it just, and I told you that the file is, it's mind-boggling how many pages there are to that file, and I think you have a little bit of information on that. Lot of work was done. The only thing is, the reason that this still haunts me is because there's never been charges brought on that individual.
What did you think when Artis came out with his book, Who Killed My Wife?
I don't know. I guess I just don't. I don't understand some of the areas that he talks about. I mean, this was a family that basically was hanging by a thread. And you read that book, and he makes it sound like losing Bernita was like the biggest loss of his life. But they weren't going to end up together anyways. She was going to divorce him. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's kind of my thought process. When I read it, I thought, well, some of it just isn't true. Some of it is kind of true, and some of it that he speaks about, I don't know. I mean, I do know, but it's from talking to other people about their family and the past and that type of thing. So I don't really know why you would. I'm not really sure what he was hoping to do with that book. To me, it didn't feel like he wrote it to find out who killed his wife. I don't know. That's the way I took it. I don't know how other people did.
He says that during your investigation, you portrayed him to the community as a cold-blooded killer, a womanizer, an intelligent, plot-planning, narcissistic psychotic.
Right.
You're okay with that description still?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So he's right on with that
one. He's right on, yeah.
Grab a glass, get comfortable. This is the part of the show that we take you behind the scenes. Alicia, I can't believe that detective said what he said, but also went on the record.
I just would like to take a deep breath. Because that is what, it's just so refreshing to, oftentimes we'll hear that stuff behind the scenes, right? Off the record, you can't say anything but this is so refreshing to actually have them come out and say this. And I understand why, because he's not the only one. Several detectives I talked to said the exact same thing. One went on the record also, and one hasn't gone on the record yet, and we'll talk about that in a minute. They say the same thing. It's been 20 years. It is time. They're like, what do we have to lose at this point? So
can we talk about, though, them actually saying his name? Mm-hmm. Typically, it is a huge no-no to name a suspect unless they have been charged. Now, there are certain times that they can do that, such as if they feel like the person is an immediate danger to society.
Of course, but Ronnie, they didn't do this. They didn't do this back then. They tiptoed around it. They said, here's the famous line they said all the time. We started in the center of the circle like you do, and we were never able to get out. That's all they would say. And Artis is the one who came out and said, I'm the main suspect. I mean, he's not dumb. He knew. He's in law enforcement. He continued working at MSP until just a few years ago when he retired.
Because I wasn't in Lansing when this case happened. I think I came later. Did you guys name Artis, or did you wait until Artis named himself?
He named himself right away. Police said that he's a person of interest. You know how they do that. The husband is always a person of interest. But to be clear, Artis White, I want to say this, it's important. He maintains his innocence. He's never been charged with a crime.
He took it to extremes, though.
He said that it's been very difficult for his family, as you can imagine. And I want to talk about the girls in a minute. But he said this has been very difficult. And he said that he spent years trying to prove to anyone who would listen that he didn't do it. And now he feels like he doesn't need, he says the people closest to him, the people who love him, the people he really cares about, know the truth, and that's good enough for him. He doesn't owe anyone anything. He said he's had a hard time with all of this.
Well, if you are truly innocent, it has to be a lot of pressure on you, how you live day to day, but also in the eyes of your kids. How do you address that? And we understand, people say they're innocent. OJ still says he's innocent. But this guy wrote a book.
Oh, a lot of people have drawn comparisons to that, because who killed my wife? It just is, it's hard. Because he knew he was a suspect and he wrote a book, Who Killed My Wife. And then he made a documentary. First, let's talk about the kids. Alana and Michaela. The Bernitas family still has a relationship with them. They're doing wonderfully. I've looked at their pictures on Facebook. They're absolutely stunning women. One of them looks just like Bernita. Wow. It's so difficult. I can't imagine what that's like, to look in the mirror and see so many similarities to your mom. And to be fair, this is all they've ever known. They were so young when this happened that they've grown up with this. And they do believe their father is innocent. And they don't want to talk about it anymore. And so, you know, we cover these cases and the families are like beating down the door. We want to talk. We want to talk. Alana and Michaela are not interested right now. An artist is done talking, he says.
What's going to be interesting to me is, as this case, it seems like at this point, it is getting new attention.
Absolutely.
How is that going to impact artists and his kids?
Right. And I know that they have, you know, media has contacted them. I'm not the only one.
Yeah.
So people are speaking with them and they're coming out and they're having to address it. Now, the documentary we mentioned was called Living Accused. And at that time, he teamed up with a few other people who had been named as suspects. Many of them were incarcerated for years and then exonerated and had to come out of it. And they spoke about that. He hosted it and kind of drew connections to his own story, his personal story. He produced it, he directed it. And when he released it, there was that like premiere. And his girls were there. They were like helping with merchandise and posing for pictures with the newspaper. A lot of people didn't like that. But they continue to support him. I spoke with one of Bernita's best friends. And she says that on top of losing her best friend, it's very difficult for her to know that the girls are out there and may not have all of the stories about their mother. And she said she literally prays every day that Alana and Michaela will pick up a phone and call her and ask about their mother to her, because she said she just, she wants them to come forward, and she just has all of these things in her heart that she wants to share with them. And that would be very difficult, because every person, Bernita's family will say the same thing, they all had their own relationship with Bernita. And when you put all of those stories together is when you get the full person of who she is. So it's hard.
Yeah, and you could see, like, your best friend knows things about you that no one else
completely
will.
And you're more candid, and you may be more willing to speak. In this case, she didn't tell her family everything that was happening behind closed doors. She told her friends, and they were the ones who went forward right away and said, "Artist did it." Her friends were the ones that came forward first. So
let's talk about the case. Where is it today? So, well, we mentioned that it's being re-examined.
It's absolutely being re-examined right now. And to give you a little history, Lansing Police presented this case twice. As I mentioned, they presented it twice to Ingham County prosecutor, who happened to go to jail after that for his own crimes.
Google him.
Yeah. So then after that happened, very colorful story. After that happened, Michigan State Police took it to the Attorney General's office. It really kind of died. Nothing was happening with it. And then during our investigation, we reapproached the Michigan State Police. Detective Sergeant Jeff Frazier is in charge of the case now. He was able to re-present the case to the Attorney General's office again. He was talking a lot, if you'll remember. He was going to go on the record. Everything was all set up. And then the plug got pulled, and he was not able to speak with us anymore on camera, which is difficult. Right. Because, you know, you're getting all this information. Somebody told him not to talk anymore. And so he was able to issue our listeners a statement. And he says, "Currently, the case is being looked at by the new administration of the Attorney General's office. I feel the case is in a good spot, as we have never been this far before."
Well, I can tell you
statement.
Who probably told him not to talk. And that would be the AG's office. Because, you know, sometimes when you work with law enforcement, like for me, I was the PIO.
Right.
You could talk, but then it starts to go up the chain and other people learn
catch
things,
wind of it.
And then it's like, okay, we're shutting this down.
Yeah, I mean, this is a big deal. I've been trying to get information on this case for 20 years, just like her family. And it at some point, you have to say, "I'm going to take this case." You have to take a risk on it. And to be clear, they are taking the case against Artis White to the Attorney General's office. That has been their case that they've taken. They even went to a cold case symposium one time in Ohio and presented the case. And all of the police officers there voted, "Yes, you have enough, take it." But it just hasn't gotten as far as it is today. Now,
so, and people should know too, when they're trying to make that decision, the detective may think there is enough, but it's really up to the prosecutor to
people who make actually have to stand in the courtroom
decision.
And present the case.
Exactly.
Because of course you may want it to go, but if you can't win in court, there's no reason to take it. I have seen a lot of the evidence in this case file, and we'll talk about the case file in a minute. I truly believe, and the detectives say, that the mound of circumstantial evidence is overwhelming. And circumstantial evidence often is, it's supposed to be always treated the exact same way as any other evidence. Now, jurors may not do that. I took you out to the zoo. We talk about the time. It all comes back to the timeline, right?
Right.
So I took you out to the zoo. We wandered around. We tried to see exactly where police decided that they think the shooter was. And then the detective took me back out and showed me exactly. And I actually did the whole trip that they believe Artis did. They believe that he said, "Okay, I'm going to pick up Alana, pick you guys back up later," got into his car, drove on a service drive that is literally connected to the zoo, got out, walked into the field, laid down only about 100 yards away. I actually laid down, held out, pretended to take a shot. Nobody could see me. Nobody could hear me. I know you're looking at the zoo, how it's laid out there.
Right,
we'll put that up on our website. And so you can see the wooded area. And it has changed over the years, obviously. But back then, there was a straight shot. And we talk about that one shot a lot. detectives at the time, I really believed it had to have been like a trained marksman or someone in the military. We kept coming back to that. And in fact, the DC Sniper Task Force actually looked into this case at one point.
Right.
Because it was associated with being a sniper. They completely ruled it out. And they do believe 100% that she was targeted. But detectives have since told me that that shot was not as crazy as we thought it was. They said anyone trained on a rifle at all with any knowledge with that scope could have taken that shot and been as accurate as the gunman was. When we come down to suspects, though, everyone's like, well, did you look at other suspects? Who are they? That's been their criticism. That's been Artis's criticism of them. But who knew that Bernita was going to be at the zoo that day? You have a very small amount of people. It was 100% targeted. They know that. So who was at the zoo that knew she was going to be there? And who had a motive?
It was Artis. I feel like because of that tight window of time, he had to plan this out.
So Potter Park and Delta Mills Park are about 10 miles apart. It takes about 20 minutes. People saw him at Delta Mills about 20 minutes after he left Potter Park. But when we did the reenactment with police, it literally took us 2 minutes to drive around, get out of the car, aim, take the shot, get back in the car, drive away. And they came back to the GPS. Artis always talks about the GPS in the vehicle.
Right.
He would never have had, it's a service drive, he would never have had to leave the zoo. It would have looked like he was just on the same path. The other thing that he brings up often, the cell phone. This was 2001. Do you remember cell phones back then? Do you remember the cell phones we had at the newsroom? It was like, you pay by the minute. You don't just call and chat to your friend. Our news director was like, you guys have 30 seconds to talk on your call. Yeah. And it's like, you're like, hey, I need a photographer, but you know, you like are yelling it out because you paid a lot of money.
You would get those phone bills and they'd be like $300 or $400. And you're like,
I know, it was crazy. But the point is, his alibi is that he was on the phone the whole time. He made a call, the person didn't answer. He left a message on the answering machine.
Right.
And then he made another call and talked to that guy all the way to the zoo. Isn't that a little strange? The cell phone thing has always been kind of a big one for me.
Can we talk about the FOIA?
Okay. So this brings us back to the case file, the circumstantial evidence. And I'm telling you, over the years, I have looked at this case file off and on, right? But I wanted the entire thing because we're doing a deep dive into this case. And so I put in the FOIA and it comes back. Price tag, $42,000. That's how big this case is. Of course, I was like, I want it, but not quite $42,000. By the way, we have a FOIA fund on our website if anyone would like to contribute. So, but I decided to cherry pick the things that I knew I wanted. I knew about that letter, the infamous letter with the big black box. I knew I wanted that. I knew I wanted 911 calls. I knew I wanted several things and everything. I wanted police interviews. Mm-hmm. I wanted the things that we normally get on a cold case and are granted. My request was approved. Then a few months later, I'm like, where is it? I check in on it. I finally get a message. Okay, your FOIA is in. You can download your documents from the portal. I ran over to my laptop, logged onto that portal, downloaded everything, opened it up, just waiting for la, and it was a bunch of blank pages. And I was like, excuse me? So I call the clerk's office.
Did they charge you for those, by the way?
Absolutely. I already had paid. I had already paid. You pay 50%.
Yeah.
Tell everyone what a FOIA is first.
Yeah. So Freedom of Information Act, it allows everyday citizens, not just reporters, not just attorneys, but you and I to request public documents. But.
And you're the expert. You request everything.
I do. FOIA, just a little trick out there. I FOIA the FOIAs. So
I didn't even know you could do this. My mind was blown when I heard this.
You can FOIA the other FOIAs or list of their FOIAs because then you know what other people are looking into.
I mean,
or working on. But it really is an important tool. But at the end of the day, these are public documents. There are documents, but there is a cost associated with it.
Okay, so I pay the money, I download the stuff, it's empty, I call the clerk, and they're like, didn't you get that other letter that we sent you? And I was like, what letter? So she sends it, I read it. Your request has been denied. I was like, excuse me? That doesn't make any sense. This is a 20-year-old cold case. Have you ever had a FOIA rescinded that was approved and paid for?
I have had cold cases denied.
Well,
But not approved, then denied.
That's very strange.
Yeah.
Very strange. In fact, if we were with a news organization, our lawyer would definitely follow up on that.
Right.
Appeal that.
And there's actually a good side to that, though, in that it appears the reason why they then denied it is because they are now taking another look at the case.
It was the exact same time that I got the message that Detective Frazier was not able to speak with me any further about this or any other case. So there is I had another case I wanted to talk to him about, but he was probably afraid I was going to ask him about this, sneak it in somehow. But I mean, listen, I've been on a mission for 20 years. I want to know why this case has never been taken into a courtroom. The family needs justice. Bernita's father died. Benny, man, he was a character. Detective Sergeant Larner says Benny called every day.
Wow.
And he sometimes multiple times a day and was just like, come on. He knew. Benny knew. Mm. And so he died not having any justice. But man, the family's still fighting. Everyone's still fighting. Anyway, the FOIA comes up. They did give me a couple little things, including, you know, the black boxes, which I wish we could, you know, hold up to the light and figure out some way. But I did do that, by the way, when I first got it. I also got some 911 calls that you'll be happy about. It goes something like this. Hi, I'd like to report a shooting at the zoo. Silence. 90 seconds goes by. Okay, thank you so much. Bye-bye. They redacted the 911 calls.
Yeah.
I mean, something's going on. So we just hope that this is because there is new life in this investigation. Her family's been through it all. Mm. They still have hope, but they've been through so many ups and downs. And I have to believe the pressure on Artis and his family is probably mounting as well. This is a hot button issue and it is getting heated again.
And you can guarantee that his old MSP buddies have let him know that they're looking into this case again.
I absolutely know that he knows about it.
So with that, we want to know what you think. Join us in on this conversation. Check out our social media.
It's time to get schooled by the teen sensation of true crime.
Here's our resident boy genius with this week's sidebar.
Hi, my name is Ryan Kester. I'm an 18-year-old pre-law junior at the University of Texas at Dallas, and ever since I was 9 years old, I've been researching cases, attending trials, and poring over hundreds of thousands of pages of court and police documents, all in the name of true crime. On today's episode of Sidebar, we're going to be discussing a topic that is a little bit more of a hypothetical than something that we might actually see, secondary murder charges. So today's case is the case of Bernita White, which, as you learned, unfortunately, upon hearing of her daughter's death, Bernita's mother, Barbara, passed away after succumbing to a heart attack. So the question posed would be, could the person who murdered Bernita also face criminal or civil charges against them for the death of Barbara? Could they be found responsible? I think that it's easier to explain this from a wide point of view and narrow it down to the specific case. Homicide, which is the act of another human's life being taken, that's the legal definition of it, can be categorized three general ways in the system. Number one, what we all think of when we talk about true crime is murder. That's the act of intentionally taking another person's life. A key element of murder in almost every state is that you have to have malice and aforethought. That doesn't necessarily mean premeditation in the traditional sense of thinking it out. Rather, you have to consciously desire to take their life without any sort of provocation or reason behind it. Not necessarily not a motive, but manslaughter, for instance, which would be the second classification, is where you recklessly take a person's life or with adequate provocation. The common example would be walking in on your spouse cheating on you. You might be able to assert the defense that it wasn't murder, it was manslaughter, because there was an adequate provocation. There was a somewhat reasonable response to a very shocking situation. Not necessarily reasonable again, but understandable almost. The third and lesser known category would be criminally negligent homicide, which is where there's no intent, there's no conscious desire to take a life, but it happens as a result of an extreme negligence, one that can't be excused. So looking at these examples, the death of Barbara unfortunately doesn't fit into any of them. Murder, there's not an intent to take Barbara's life. There might be an intent to take Bernita's, but the prosecution couldn't assert that they also intended to kill Barbara. Manslaughter, there's not an adequate provocation, and even looking at it from an involuntary perspective, you couldn't consciously realize that there was a risk there to take the life of another person. Bernita, again, yes, but not Barbara. The person who committed the murder would have no way of knowing that that would also cause the death of Barbara. So looking at it from a criminally negligent point of view, again, in my opinion, I just don't see a prosecutor being able to prove that, because not only would you have to prove that there was some knowledge or risk that this would cause the death of Barbara, you would have to prove that this did cause the death of Barbara, which unfortunately, as I do believe it's possible to die from a broken heart, the stress of the murder is simply not enough to rise to the element of criminal charges, if that makes sense. It's a very sad case, but it's not likely one that would see the inside of a courtroom. On that note, I do have to get back to writing my paper, but I'll see you guys next time for the next episode of Sidebar.
Before we go, we have 1 minute each for final arguments. I will be arguing first to the Attorney General of Michigan, Dana Nessel. Can you hear me? I have two words. It's time. Justice is calling. 20 years. It's time. Every single detective on this case is convinced. They all know. I've covered a lot of circumstantial cases where prosecutors take a look at it, and especially if it's cold, they'll call the family in and get real with them. Listen, we only get one shot at this. We like our chances or we wouldn't be sitting here, but we could lose. And then it's over. We don't get another chance. Let Bernita's family make this call. And once this gets inside a courtroom, because it will, to the future jurors, let me remind you that circumstantial evidence, and you will see there is a lot, bears the same weight legally as a smoking gun, bullet fragment, or any physical evidence. Bernita's family deserves this. The community deserves this. It's time. Ronnie?
Time's up. Closing arguments. A lot of resources have been dedicated to trying to solve Bernita's murder. I'm not saying her family does not deserve justice. However, as a prosecutor once told me, cold case investigations aren't like fine wine sitting around getting better with time. Unless new evidence comes to light, move on. Other families want justice for their loved ones as well. I didn't even take my full minute for that.
Wow. Well, I would like to take the rest of your time, but I know that's not how it works. So with that, we really want to send out a big prayers, thoughts, everything to Bernita's family in this. Bernita and Barbara both deserve justice in whatever form that may take. And until then, we'll see you next week.